Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and today is an extremely special day.
How much is that doggy in the window?
Our entire hour is dedicated to one topic, a fuzzy, playful, snuffly, snuggly topic, dogs. Let's look backward. Maybe 18 months ago, give or take, to start. The pandemic was still in the early stages, offices tentatively pushing back those return dates month after month, and it was getting clearer by the day we were going to be in quarantine for a while. So people started looking around their homes they were now trapped in and finding them a little empty. You know what could fill that space? A dog. Let the pandemic puppy craze begin. Now, according to a survey done by the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, 23 million households in the U.S. welcomed a new pet into their house during the pandemic, and we want to know if you are one of them. Did you get a pandemic puppy? How's it been if you have? Are things changing in your house now that people are heading back to the office or some other kind of work? Tell us about it. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. Joining us now, Mike Kiley, Director of Adoption Centers and Programs at the MSPCA. Mike, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It is great to have you. I just kind of want to ask you, how big was the surge here, Mike?
Well, in terms of interest for adoption during the pandemic, it reached new heights that I'd never seen before. And I thought there was a lot of interest in adoption leading into the pandemic. And I was totally blown away by how much interest there was since the start of the pandemic.
Did it happen all at once? Like we're going along and going along and then boom, the phones just start ringing at, you know, triple off the hook? Or was it a gradual ramp up in, let's say, that first 6 to 12 months?
It happened pretty immediately. I think that was what was surprising to us. And, you know, typically in New England, the time of year in which the pandemic started was usually a slower month for us in terms of intake of animals for adoption. So it came right at a time where our population was a bit lower. And, you know, when we placed animals up for adoption on our website or on our social media, we were overwhelmed by the number of people who applied for each and every animal. It didn't matter if they were old or big or certain breeds. Every dog that people were interested in, every dog that we've made available, there was tons of interest.
So I'm trying to kind of get a sense of before or after. I wonder, you know, do you know on a given year prior to the pandemic, how many dogs might your shelter have adopted out? And how many did you adopt in the first year of the pandemic?
Yeah, actually, it's, you know, typically our organization was adopting out about 1,500 dogs per year. You know, we see more other species like cats and other small animals than we do see dogs in locally. And, you know, we saw a really surprising trend that we didn't anticipate. Normally, when there's major events, natural disasters or other things, there is usually a flood of animals that enter our system as a result, or enter shelters around the country. And we just anticipated, having never been through a pandemic, that because that was such a major event, that we would see a similar trend of animals needing to come in to care and ultimately get adopted. And we saw the exact opposite. We saw that people are holding on to their animals and that our intake rate dropped by 30%. But at the same time, the surge in interest tripled, you know, or quadrupled. It's hard to quantify. And we would get hundreds of inquiries per animal. So, you know, there were times throughout the pandemic where we had sometimes in our larger shelter systems only one or two dogs available for adoption, but people calling constantly looking for that companionship. And I think that makes sense. Everybody was very scared and we're going through this unprecedented event in our lifetime. And we know that dogs especially really do provide that comfort and companionship that I think everybody was looking for. So it made sense that everybody was interested, just so it coincided with a lower intake than we were expecting.
So, Mike, we have two adopted dogs in my house right now. Sonny and Ernie are 13 and 14. We adopted them about 5 years ago after our previous adopted dog, Elvis, passed away. And we went through some pretty serious vetting in both cases to adopt the dogs. And I wonder, with this kind of demand, were you able to do the vetting you might do otherwise? And B, as everybody was looking for a dog, did you worry at all about households not really knowing what they were getting into or being prepared for the commitment that is having a dog?
It's a great question. I think one of the things that we pride ourselves on our organization is to not put up lots of barriers for adoption. I think, we have chosen to trust the intentions of people coming in to adopt. You know, that's our message. We've been putting that message out for decades, is that we have homeless animals that, need to get out of shelters and into loving homes. And so instead of grilling people and really, maybe judging people is be the right word, we really changed our process to be an open invitation for conversation and really focus on the matchmaking components of making sure that it's a good union between the animal and the person. And so we didn't want to change that direction. We really wanted to welcome people that wanted to adopt and really focus on who that dog was, who the adopter was, and make sure that it was a good fit. And of course, we've never been through a pandemic. Neither had anybody that was interested in adopting. So we, of course, had conversations about, lifestyle changes that may happen as a result of the pandemic. And I think as a field, we have a tendency to doubt the intentions of adopters rather than embrace when people reach out to us. And I never doubted for a moment from any conversations we had with people that were adopting that they had anything but the best intentions for the animal and for their family, and really wanting that family to be a complete family, meaning adding a dog to their household to really get that full family feeling.
So listeners, let me turn to you. We'd love to hear one of your stories about your pandemic puppy adoption. Who is your dog? When did you adopt? How's it going? Mike, I'll come back to you. Okay, so now we're months into this. Oh, actually, I've got a caller here. So let's go to that. Let's talk to Jens in Sherburn. Jens, go ahead.
Yes, we ended up getting dogs, even though I explicitly made it clear I didn't want dogs. My wife kind of enforced them upon us, and we even had a family gathering where I declared, if the dogs come in, I'm out. Finally, they convinced me, and now I'm the one who's involved with the dogs more than they are.
And do you love them, Jens?
We declare them COVID puppies.
Jens, thank you for that. There was an entire social media push for a while, Mike, of pictures of households where the dad said no dog, and now the dad is totally the dog lover in the family. Are you following households like a Jens household? How are they doing with their pandemic pooch? Months or days or weeks or years later?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we're always encouraged by the follow-up that we get from people who adopted. And that story is a really a common occurrence. A lot of times people really intentionally choose to add an animal to their household, and that is a full family discussion and everyone embraces it. Other times animals come into our lives in unexpected ways, and we've certainly seen that with the stray cat that shows up for food and someone embraces that and takes the animal into their home. And I think what we learned through this process is just how important animals are to our family. And so, when that flush of animals didn't happen as an intake as we predicted, we really turned our attention to making sure that the animals that were in our community and already a valued member of the family were able to stay with them. We saw that there was a lot of worry that because of health or economics or losing a job and that there was a real possibility that animals would start to get separated from their humans that loved them. And we really wanted to make sure that didn't happen. So we've been delivering pet meals to food pantries to make sure that pets were fed during this pandemic, as well as into isolated individuals. We provided access to affordable veterinary care to make sure that didn't become a barrier for someone keeping their animal. And we've delivered over 3 million meals to food pantries and individuals since the beginning of this pandemic. And it's all in service of making sure that human-animal bond continues. And for those that, did need to separate from their animals for very real and challenging reasons, that we would also have a safe place for them to go and be able to get into a new loving family.
Mike, is there a pandemic match that warms your heart, a particular dog with a particular family?
Oh, that's a great question. I'm searching back in my memory, but I think, one of the things that I would say just as a generalization, and I can't think of a very specific example at the moment, but, some of the animals that might have a harder time getting adopted, animals with behavior issues or senior animals, we were really delighted to see that those animals got new attention and new interest and were able to get into homes so much faster as a result of the interest in adoption. So, there's definitely a number of those examples that are spinning in my mind, but I think I was very, it was very heartwarming to see that that people reached out and really looked beyond some of the things that they might have not looked at before and took on some animals that maybe they didn't originally think would be the profile of the dog that they had in their mind, but have had such a loving and wonderful relationship with them since.
Let's hear from Brian real quick in Boston. Brian, go ahead. You're on.
Hey, how's it going? Thank you for taking my call. My wife and I got two pandemic puppies. We actually had planned on getting puppies in like December before the pandemic started. We're waiting for my semester end. And, you know, once the pandemic happened, we were like, we need to do this still. And we were lucky enough to get two babies from Georgia. They were 8 weeks old. And we actually changed our whole lifestyle around it, but it kept us out and in the neighborhood during the pandemic. And we actually got a travel trailer so that we were able to travel last summer, because as you can imagine, two lab mixes are not the greatest hotel dogs as babies. So it really, it was a great experience for us. And we had our old guy for 12 years, and it took us 3 years to be able to like move on to new puppies. And it really kept us active during the pandemic, kept us out, kept us walking, meeting neighbors, et cetera.
That's great, Brian. Thanks for telling us your story. So, Mike, last question to you. So if there's someone out there now thinking about adopting a dog, what's your message to them?
Well, we definitely need adopters more than ever. I think certainly that big spike that we just talked about during the start of the pandemic has started to slow a little bit. And we are seeing that some of the bigger dogs or certain breeds or ages or dogs with some challenges medically or behaviorally are having a little bit more trouble finding homes. And we've made a lot of changes to be able to help bring animals up to Massachusetts to help, help communities throughout the country that are overwhelmed with the number of animals now coming into their shelters to be able to help those animals get into homes. We affiliated with Northeast Animal Shelter January of last year and brought in almost 4,000 cats and dogs to Massachusetts for adoption from other shelters in other parts of the country. And that profile is, we're seeing that slowing process probably back to that 2019 interest level that people are interested in adopting dogs, but certain categories are getting overlooked. So I encourage everyone to sort of take a fresh look at all the animals that are up for adoption and, maybe think past the eyes and really look at the personality, and we'd be happy to help people find a match if they're still looking for a dog out there.
All right. Mike Kiley, Director of Adoption Centers and Programs at the MSPCA, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We are spending the hour on dogs today. They give us so much, and sometimes they serve us, too. They help identify seizures, serve as eyes or ears, even assist with manual tasks. NEEDS is a local nonprofit that raises and trains service dogs. Their clients range from veterans to teachers to victims of the Boston Marathon bombings and so many more. NEEDS caught our attention recently when they announced their latest litter of puppies in training. The litters don't get names right away, but they're assigned these themes at birth. And this one was Pasta. And let me just tell you, the picture of the one with the bow tie made of farfalle nearly killed me. So cute. So joining us now, Kathy Zamitis, who is Director of Development at NEEDS, the organization dedicated to raising, training, and placing service dogs with people who need them. Kathy, thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Also with us, Caitlin Steinke, a former Paralympic rower for Team USA and owner of one of these NEEDS service dogs, Jones. Caitlin, welcome.
Thank you for having us.
And welcome to Jones, too.
He's right here.
I'm sure. All right. So let me start with you, Kathy. Tell us, what is everything a service dog can do? Or maybe it's easier to tell us what they can't do.
Service dogs are pretty darn special. The service dogs that are brought through by NEEDS are trained in up to 60 different tasks and commands. So they can do everything from turning on and off the lights in a room to opening a refrigerator door, fetching something from the refrigerator, shutting the door and bringing it to their person. They stand and brace to help if someone's fallen down. They pick things up. I could go on and on about 50 or 60 different tasks and commands.
Caitlin, tell us a little bit about Jones.
So I was matched with Jones just barely 5 years ago now, and I couldn't live independently without him. He will be turning 7 this year. He is a male yellow lab, and he is everything you could ask for from a service dog. His obedience, which is incredibly important for us to be able to go out in public and travel the country, is impeccable. He has better manners than most humans. And his task work, he makes him a medical device. And his task work keeps me safe every single day. As a full-time wheelchair user, he cuts my risk of falling. He can speak on command or find my phone by scent so that I am safe if I do need help. He is just so solid. He does everything I ask the first time I ask, and it makes me feel very confident and independent in having him.
He sounds like a real partner.
We are definitely a team. He usually gets a hello before I do, but I'm okay with that. He's the better looking of the two.
And just quickly, is he your first service dog?
He is my second service dog and my first through needs. I did extensive research in knowing quite a few service dogs after my years with my first. And after researching deeply, needs was the only answer for me.
So, Kathy, you know, based on what we're hearing from Caitlin, a service dog, it's serious business. And I don't mean business, I mean serious. I mean, this is a working dog. Tell us a little bit about, yeah.
Sure. This is definitely a working dog. It is not a pet, but that's not to say that they don't have some wonderful pet-like qualities, which I'm sure Caitlin and Jones can attest to. You know, we here at Needs are a team of about 40 people directly at Needs who work very hard on the breeding, raising, training, and matching of our world-class service dogs. But equally, if not more important, are the volunteers that surround us. And those volunteers are our inmate handlers. 6 different prisons in Massachusetts and Rhode Island. Inmates help us raise and train these dogs. And on the weekends, we have wonderful individuals and families who go to the prisons and take the dogs out and help us socialize them, because if they're living in the prison, they're not getting the everyday experiences that they need to have before they go out and work with one of our clients. We also have full-time puppy raisers who take the pups when they're about 8 to 12 weeks old, and they have them for about a year, and then the dogs go into prison. These raisers, we call them our puppy raisers, are so important to us. And if I can just mention that we're always looking for weekend and full-time puppy raisers, they are the backbone of our organization. And I think Caitlin will attest that Jones had an excellent puppy raiser.
So I want to talk a little bit more about that. And Caitlin, I will turn to you. Was there some part of what Jones was capable of or trained to do that surprised you?
Still to this day. I just bought my first home. We just moved recently. Since he's been with me, we've been in a one-bedroom apartment. So there was one entryway door, and now we have 3 entryway doors, and our refrigerator has 4 doors. And, you know, coming in and renaming behaviors and naming multiple doors, and he went from having 80 commands to 85 commands in less than 2 weeks, just because I had to name new things. And within 2 sessions, I could call a door from any room, and he would go shut it.
What would a name of a door be, Caitlin? I'm sorry to interrupt. What would a name of a door be? Like the 4 refrigerator doors, what is that command for Jones?
So depending on what I want out of the fridge, I would normally, on our old fridge, I would say fridge, which meant get a bottle of water, or I would say snack, which meant get something off the snack drawer, which could have been a sandwich or some carrot sticks in a baggie. Now with a French door fridge, the bottom drawer is a freezer, and there's multiple doors on top. So now fridge means open the right door where the bottle of water is, and snack means tug the left door. If I need both open, then I say full fridge, and he'll just tug both. And with the entryway doors, door was just go do the door, because we only had one, and now we have door, and then we also have porch and deck. So he's been able to learn those very, very quickly. He still amazes me. And to Kathy's point, there wouldn't be a Jones. There wouldn't be these incredible medical devices that are service dogs without puppy raisers.
So we're hearing from Caitlin Steinke, former Paralympic rower for Team USA, who has a service dog named Jones, and Kathy Zamitis, Director of Development at Needs, which raises, trains, and places service dogs. Kathy, we were just hearing from Caitlin about the door work that Jones can do. We have a little clip of one of the dogs in training practicing door opening skills. Here's the trainer.
Are you ready? Are you ready? Tug. Hold. Tug. Hold. Give. Good boy.
Is this like going to college for a puppy? I mean, the level of training and the sophistication of it?
It's like going to an Ivy League college. And I love hearing that Jones is still learning new tasks, because one of the important things that our pups do is they learn how to learn. And there's a very important window of time in a dog's life where they learn how to learn. And that's before they're 3 months old, believe it or not. And so Jones obviously learned how to learn very well in his Ivy League education, because he's still able to pretty quickly pick up task work. And yeah, our dog, we're very proud of our dogs, and we're proud of the education that they receive. And we're extremely proud of our clients when they're matched and they go off and they do their job and they're still learning, which is a wonderful thing.
I've got to believe, Kathy, that the vast majority of dogs can't do this. Am I wrong?
No, most of the dogs can learn the task work. As I said, we have a team that helps our dogs along, and not everybody is blessed with a team of people that starts to socialize the puppies before they're 8 weeks old and has inmate handlers who work with them 24/7 and so on. But most dogs can learn, some task work, some tricks, definitely obedience. One of the things that's really difficult is to find a dog that can do all of those things consistently, always, no matter what's going on around them, be it at a basketball game, on a train, on a plane, on a crowded street. They have to be cool, calm, collected, and keep their attention on their person. And that isn't something that all dogs can do. And that is one of the reasons that we use largely purpose-bred pups. And we have our own breeding program. We work with other ADI certified organizations across the country with their breeding programs, so that we are purpose breeding service dogs. And that really helps with temperament and soundness of mind and limb. So we start off with a dog that we're pretty sure is going to be successful. But having said that, only 50% of the dogs that start our program make it through our
program. So what happens to the other 50%?
The other 50% are adopted out as beloved pets.
So that makes me happy. So, Kate, let me come back to you. We have heard an increase in news stories over the last couple of years about people using all kinds of animals as emotional support animals, informal service animals. Caitlin, your reaction to that, as someone who has a dog that I've noticed multiple times during this conversation, you have referred to as a medical device.
And I know a lot of people think that sounds pretty harsh, but I love him dearly.
Oh, yeah.
He is sitting on top of my lap at the moment at 65 pounds, listening to every word. He gets chiropractic adjustments and massages and has a fenced-in yard. And, you know, I love him very, very much. But when he is working, he is medical equipment, and that's very important because he's expensive. A lot of people went into making him that way, of course. I think a lot of pets could be labeled as emotional support. I think anyone who's had a dog or a cat in their life can say that. But those animals don't get granted public access, and there's a reason for that. They don't require training. They don't require anything, and they can be any type of animal. And we are protected as a handler team by the ADA to go into public because we are backed that he is trained and he will keep other people out in public safe. He will keep me safe. He will not disturb the order of the business that we're in or the flight that we're on. It's very dangerous for waitresses or children running around. If an unsound, untrained dog is out in public lunging and barking, it can get out of hand very, very quickly. So it's not only dangerous for legitimate teams, but it is also dangerous for the general public to have untrained, stressed out dogs in those scenarios.
So, Kathy, do we have a public policy need here? Oh, did we lose Kathy?
Nope, I'm still here.
Do we have a public policy need on this front, Kathy?
Yes, I am getting a little interference on the line, but I can still hear you. We do have We are hoping that House Bill 1565 does get through. It is a bill brought forth by Representative Kimberly Ferguson in the hopes that we will be able to make the false representation of a pet as a service dog illegal.
And are you getting good traction in the legislature for it?
We have great traction in the legislature, but like everything, we came to a sliding halt with COVID. So we're still in the wait and see. And if it doesn't get through in this session, we will refile the bill and keep on going.
Caitlin, it's in the back of my mind. The whole time we've been talking to you, I've been thinking about the fact that this is your second service dog. And I wonder if there's anything you want to tell us about your first.
She is a lovely dog. She was with me for my experience rowing on the national team. She was with me, you know, within the appropriate time after my injury, and she was my first service dog. She's still alive. I love her dearly. She was retired early, unfortunately, because of an unprovoked attack by another dog. Mm. And it was, you know, after five different attacks, this was just the final one, and I just could not continue to put her through that in life and constantly being attacked. And the last one caused some enough damage that it was time to retire her. So she was only 4 and a half when she was retired. And I was so fortunate to have the knowledge to find the appropriate school for me for my second dog. And needs was the only answer to that question. I cannot imagine my life without Jones by my side. We travel the country. We travel all the time, obviously. Again, COVID put a big slam on that, but we are back to traveling for work. And, you know, he's never blinked at anything. He's never worried or thought about anything. The education that he learned through his experiences with needs and the puppy raisers and the inmate handler are just invaluable. He is so solid, and I'm so confident having him with me.
And Kathy, just very briefly, if somebody wants to get involved, what can they do?
They can go to needs.org and they can fill in a little survey, if you will, talking to trying to become a puppy raiser or any other kind of volunteer, and we will get right back to them.
All right. Kathy Zimaitis is Director of Development at Needs. And Caitlin Steinke is a former Paralympic rower for Team USA and owner of the Needs service dog Jones. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Stay tuned. When we come back, it's not Ask the Doctors, but it is Ask the Vets. We have two vets available to take your canine questions. What do you need to know about your pooch? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston as we continue this dog theme hour. I'm Tiziana Deering, and you are listening to Radio Boston. We have gone to the dogs today on purpose, and now we are bringing you a new twist on a Radio Boston regular. It is not Ask the Doctors, but it is Ask the Vets.
Lie down, Chauncey. Lie down! Lie down, Chauncey!
He's deaf.
I'm not deaf. I just can't stand listening to her.
Since we can't all hear what our dogs have to say, like Dr. Doolittle there can, and by the way, thank God for that, we are turning to veterinarians to answer our pooch-related puzzles instead. What food is best for a senior pooch? Is the amount of barking your dog does normal? We have two vets here to answer, so give us a call. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. And those of you who already have, I love it that you are including your dog pics. Keep those coming. So joining us now, Dr. Indu Mani, an associate vet at VCA Brookline Animal Hospital and chief scientific officer at Brief Media, which is a publication for fellow veterinarians. She's also a current bioethics fellow at the Harvard Medical School. Dr. Mani, welcome.
Thank you so much, Tiziana. I'm so happy to be here.
It's great to have you. We also have Dr. Monica Mansfield, who is a veterinarian at Medway Animal Hospital and president-elect of the Massachusetts Veterinary Medical Association. Dr. Mansfield, welcome to you as well.
Thank you so much, Tiziana, for having me on your show. What a wonderful program you have. And also, those needs dogs are tremendous dogs. I agree.
really fun to learn about them, isn't it? And I'm happy to have both of you. And listen, normally I would start with some questions of my own, but the phones have already exploded, as has the Twitter sphere. So if the two of you are ready, I think we're going to just dive right in. How does that sound?
Perfect.
Okay.
We're ready.
Great. And I am going to start with a tweet from Julie Hall, mostly because her dog picture of what has got to be a Maltese mix is just killing me. And it says, help at Radio Boston, need advice for codependency with my dog post-COVID. It's a real problem for both of us. I cannot leave her. Dr. Mani, we hear this a lot, especially as people are starting to leave the home more. Separation anxiety, the dog not wanting the person to leave, the person being anxious about leaving the dog. Advice.
It really is it was a burgeoning problem to some extent, even before COVID, and because of the intensity with which dogs and their owners have spent time, it's become something we've heard almost as a refrain every day that we go to work. So it's, first of all, I would say, you know, it's a great question and thank you for asking it. And you're probably asking something that many, many other people want to know too. So I think the best way to first start to deal with some of the separation anxiety and their associated behaviors is to talk to your veterinarian, to talk about ruling out medical issues first, to be on the safe side, and then also to start talking about behavior modification. Your veterinarian will help you learn how to exit the house more readily, how to keep your dog safe when you do have to exit the house, how to give certain potential calming supplements that have evidence behind them. And if you need to, there's absolutely no shame in psychotropic medications to help ease those separations.
All right, thank you. Now I'll go from Twitter to the phones, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK on this Ask the Veterinarians. Your dog questions, we've got Jan in Newton. Jan, go ahead.
Yes, hi, thank you. I just had a question about whether or not there's any concern if a dog is a runt of the litter, if there are any health concerns that could be happening in the future.
Dr. Mansfield.
Yes, Jan, I think it's a case-by-case basis. And with any dog that you do adopt, I think it would be a very good idea to have your veterinarian take a look. What we're looking for when we examine an animal is to make sure in a puppy that there are any congenital disorders, congenital malformations, heart murmurs, things along that lines that we can figure out whether or not that is a problem. But very many times, being the runt of the litter, if it's just a smaller dog or the last one that came out from that poor mother that pushed out 8 puppies, it doesn't mean there's necessarily anything wrong with that dog. It might be the most endearing, sweet, lovely dog. So I don't see being the runt of the litter being a bad thing. I think it just is case by case, and probably want to have a veterinarian check it out to make sure we can't find anything wrong with it as well.
All right, let's take another call here, 800-423-8255. We've got Jamie on the line in Amherst, New Hampshire. Jamie, go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a 100-pound Bernese Mountain Dog. He's fixed. He's almost 4 years old, and he is very attached to me, to the point that if I'm at home, he won't go outside with anyone else. And he's becoming rather aggressive towards my 17-year-old son if he gets near me. He's on a dose of Clomicom, a half a pill, in the evening and in the morning. But he's actually getting a little bit more aggressive, and I'm wondering if there's training I can do to help that.
Dr. Mani.
Jamie, thank you so much for a really great question. And Bernese Mountain Dogs are so beautiful. So I can imagine what he looks like. This can be a common situation. And I think the most important thing is to center on a diagnosis first. Dogs have the same range of psychopathologies, I believe, that human beings do. Human beings are really troubled with anxiety right now. And many of our dogs are showing common signs of anxiety. I would talk to your veterinarian. We have the American College of Veterinary Behavior. They're board certified behaviorists. They have amazing positive reinforcement trainers. It's what we usually endorse in the profession. And I would talk to your veterinarian. I don't know in New Hampshire where you are, if there are some boarded local behaviors. Luckily, there are boarded behaviors who will communicate and counsel your veterinarian to help you do a multimodal program to help attenuate some of those aggressive behaviors that you're seeing.
So I'm going to pick up a call on behalf of Karen and Newton. Her sound is bad, but she says that she has a service dog that has acid reflux and no one can solve it. Do you have any ideas? Dr. Mansfield, I'll bring that one to you.
Sure. And we want to be careful about not prescribing medication specifically over the phone. And it is, you know, going back to that case by case basis. But in a lot of cases of acid reflux, we do have success with one form or another of medication that may quiet down that acid. In some cases, though, their dogs do benefit from seeing an internal medicine specialist. I did have one case that was way over the top with her acid reflux, a young golden retriever, and had a scope put down there. And they were, the internists were able to see the tissue that was so inflamed and that's what the trouble was. And so that dog needed a large array of maybe three or four different meds, but then it was so much better. No looking back after that. But I'd say, you know, a vast majority on a trial of one or the other medications that their veterinarian would probably be able to prescribe. And if one's not working, please let your veterinarian know, Karen, that because we want to make it better and make your dog feel better as well.
And Dr. Mansfield, just briefly, if someone did want to find a specialist, like an internal, I'm sorry, I don't remember.
Medicine, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I was like internal medicine, right? An
right,
internal
exactly.
medicine specialist. Where does one find a specialist like that in the veterinary world?
Wonderful question. And that is probably all by referral. So you would start with your general practitioner, veterinarian, your regular practitioner. And then there are just wonderful, we're so blessed in this area to have so many excellent specialists, board certified internal medicine specialists tend to be at the larger facilities. So like Tufts and Grafton, Tufts in Walpole, Angel Memorial in Boston. There are several other large facilities that are just tremendous with their care there. So your veterinarian would start to facilitate that.
And just briefly, it sounds expensive. Any way to help offset costs of something like that for a dog owner?
Yes. A couple thoughts. One thing that would be, a really wonderful, tremendous kind of forethought if one is in that situation is when your dog is young, if you can start off with pet insurance for the unforeseeable things, it can really help a lot. But they don't cover any pre-existing conditions. So you can't already have the condition and then sign up for the pet insurance. But as a foresight thing, that's a wonderful thing, and maybe keeping a savings for future unforeseen things. But in the moment, when we do have a situation that's going to need workups that might be, in the thousands of, a couple thousand dollars to do, a lot of the large facilities, and I know our hospital has some programs. Ours is called Care Credit, which a lot of the human practices use and our practice use that help people to space out their payments. And even talking to the individual facility, case by case, hospital by hospital, might have a situation where they can work out a payment plan as well.
Thank you for that, Dr. Mansfield. And I'll underscore something you said earlier. As with Ask the Doctors, these are general answers to your questions, but they are not a substitute for actual medical advice from the veterinarian that treats your dog. All right, we have so many calls and more tweets come in. Let's try to get through as many as we can. I'm going to go back to a tweet here. This is from Ezra Dunkel-Polier, who says, longtime dog owner, but first time with a puppy. What are the best options for home training? There seem to be several arguments for and against using choke collars, for example. So, Dr. Mani, I'll come back to you on that one.
Yeah, absolutely. And Ezra, a great question. Training is always such a diverse range of methodologies that are out there and to seek for dog owners. In the veterinary profession in general, especially as recommended by our American College of Veterinary Behaviorists, we tend to avoid aversive training methods like choke collars or prong collars. I know that it's really hard when you have a crazy, insane puppy who is dragging you down the street. I had one of those that I rescued, and he would drag me down the street whenever I tried to walk him. But I would get in contact with a positive reinforcement trainer. It's not really a behavior issue when they're pulling and running around like crazy. They're just exuberant, wonderful, happy creatures when they're babies. And you just have to teach them how to behave appropriately with positive reinforcement, which probably works better for all of us.
This is a special dog-focused hour of Radio Boston, and we are doing Ask the Vets with Dr. Indu Mani from VCA Brookline Animal Hospital and Dr. Monica Mansfield from Medway Animal Hospital. The phone number to ask your veterinary question about the dog you love, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. We have Jana on the line in Berlin. Jana, go ahead.
Hi, we have a five-year-old Cavalier King Charles, and she licks so much. She licks, like, all the time. Sometimes she, like, licks air. Sometimes she licks blankets. And we're wondering if that's something we could help her with, or if it's normal, or if we should do something.
So, Dr. Mansfield, I'm curious on this. Our last dog was a Licky Lou as well. I'm curious about the answer here.
Well, Jana, we love cavies, as we call them. We affectionately call them cavies, but the Cavalier King Charles Spaniels are just known for just being total sweethearts, just lovely dogs. And so, but sometimes they're mysterious in why they're doing the things that they're doing, because it might just be out of love. But
enigmatic.
Sometimes I think it's most likely, from what you're describing, potentially a behavioral thing. There might have been one little reward that she got when maybe there was something that tasted good on a blanket at one point, so she keeps trying to get that. On the other hand, going back to that reflux question that Karen from Newton asked, that, you know, sometimes that's a sign of reflux. If, you know, a dog is licking, they may be having some acid reflux come back. I think as Dr. Mani and I have both been saying, that this might be one to run past your veterinarian just to go over, you know, have a good exam. And we might not be able to tell you on the exam, but they might rule out something like reflux with an antacid, for instance, just to see. But it could be a behavioral thing. I once had a cat. He was a blind cat that we had these plastic bags on the floor where we had brought some milk in, and one drop of milk got on the plastic bag. And for the rest of his life, every time he saw a plastic bag, every time he experienced one, he had to keep licking because he was hoping a drop of milk would be there again. Sometimes they generalize over a behavioral thing.
Hope springs eternal. All right, I'm going to go back to Twitter for this one, because we love the dog and the picture and the question. So this is from Sloanish. At Radio Boston, if Clem the Monster was a street dog living outside a supermarket for first 2.5 years of life, is it at all possible to make her less of a trash-finding and eating expert? Dr. Mani.
I seem to be getting a lot of behavioral questions.
I guess I'm giving them all to you, aren't I? Sorry about that.
Yeah, no, that's okay. I hope I can do them justice. It just goes right back. Dogs, the beauty of dogs is that they're, and Sloanish, it is another fabulous question. Dogs are just so anxious to please. Dogs are so intelligent. Dogs are so eminently trainable. And so I would enthusiastically say to you, yes, it is possible to train your dog not to eat everything that it sees. That said, never rely on a dog's sense of good, a dog's good sense. I know that Dr. Mansfield will attest to the fact that we have removed pretty much anything that you could imagine from the stomach of a dog and from the intestines of dogs who knows why they eat what they eat. So it's just important to do your best, restrict access to things that the dog may go after, put food up high, don't leave your laundry out. If you know that your dog is going to go for things, keep them separated from those things when you're not able to watch, and then just keep the training going best as you can.
All right, Dr. Mansfield, I'll go to David in Lexington, and we'll give you, this might be our last one, we're running low on time, but I'll give you a behavioral question. David, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My border collie, who's 9.5 and who I got at 6.5 after she'd worked on a farm, is very afraid of nervous in the car. I've actually had to trank her on road trips recently, and I would love to make her easier in the car. I should say that for her first 6 months, she really had a traumatic situation. She was in a basement with very little human care, so she missed that. But she's a lovely dog. She's well-trained generally by the person who owns a farm where she worked.
So, David, I'm going to take it back from you there. Thanks for telling us more about her, but I do want to make sure we have time to get you your answer. So, Dr. Mansfield.
David, I'm so glad you have your beautiful dog. Border collies are very intelligent dogs. They're very busy dogs. They want a job to do. And her being afraid of the car might be a couple things. One might be nausea. So, there may be worth you discussing with your vet. Should we consider trying some anti-nausea medication before a car ride? We do have a prescription one, and sometimes there are over-the-counter ones that your veterinarian might try. But they're definitely, as Dr. Mani said in a prior question, sometimes we give some mildly sedating medication to just have the overthinking in the dog's mind stop overthinking for just the car ride. They're just going in the car, but for them, the vibrations and sensations, we can't really reason with them and tell them in English, you know, what's going on. So there might be a calling for that to just make it more pleasant. And then, David, also try to go face places that are super fun with your border collie that she can't wait to get to. Find a walk around a lake or something that's going to be super exciting, or even a drive to Dunkin' Donuts for the donut holes there that might make short little car rides fun, or longer ones fun too.
So condition her really to like the car rides by what happens on the other end.
Yes. And then because border collies always want a job to do, make sure that she's getting enough exercise too, that so that, you know, that she's used to outings. So yes, Tiziana, like you just said.
All right. So listen, the lines are still full, but we are out of time for calls. So I want to thank all the listeners who called. We weren't able to get to your calls. The response tells us maybe this is something we will do again sometime. In the meantime, I want to thank our veterinarians, Dr. Indu Mani, who is an associate veterinarian at VCA Brookline Animal Hospital, and Dr. Monica Mansfield, who is a veterinarian at Medway Animal Hospital. Thanks to both of you for helping out so many people who love their dogs today.
Thank you, Tiziana.
Thank you, Tiziana.
And thank you, Dr. Mani.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Mansfield.
Very fun to have you. And that is our show for today, folks. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick and Amanda Beeland, with a ton of work today from Sarah Leeson and also help from Francisca Monahan. Marquise Neal is our technical director. Karen Schiffman, our interim executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. That was fun. Thanks for joining us. And join us again tomorrow when we'll have Radio Boston's Week in Review.